Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, David Lichtenstein, number 11408, appearing for the appellant, Reed Lester. With me at counsel table is Ariel DeFazio. This case squarely presents this court with an issue of statutory construction on which there is no controlling authority in Colorado. The essence of the main issue is, how should a trial court exercise its discretion in determining whether to award fees to a prevailing plaintiff under the Wage Claim Act? It's interesting that the defendants restate this first issue in terms of the district court having applied the plain language of the Act and the factors described in the Carruthers and Graham cases. True, Carruthers did say that the statute is clear and unambiguous in conferring discretion on trial courts. But Carruthers said a lot more. It went on to extensively explore the legislative history of the 2007 amendments to the Wage Claim Act, and the legislative history included the express legislative declaration. Now, the Carruthers opinion states that the panel did this in the service of rejecting the employee's argument in that case that the employer could recover its fees when it prevailed only if the employee's claim was frivolous. But even after rejecting that position, the Carruthers panel went on to observe, citing about 8 cases, that there are many situations where discretion is conferred on a trial court, but there are bounds to that discretion and there are factors and considerations that must come into play governing that discretion.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you on that. That last part of the Carruthers opinion that you're referring to, or the second part, wasn't that expressly described as an alternative holding, alternative to this primary holding that the statute was plain and unambiguous?
Well, it was, and yet what the opinion said and what it actually proceeded to do, I think, have to be considered two different things, because it expressly held that there are 10 factors that a court should consider when awarding or deciding whether to award fees to an employer. So, I don't know if you'd call it an alternative holding or something else, but it had to be considered holding because it directed, it remanded the court, the case to the trial court to apply those factors in light of the facts of the case.
Thank you.
Sure. And the court did one other very important thing in Carruthers, which was to expressly provide that it expressed no opinion on what factors should come into play when the employee prevails. That's footnote 11. So when the defendants say that the district court was correct to apply the Carruthers factors to this case, that's wrong, because even the Carruthers court wasn't willing to go that far.
But the Carruthers court didn't say it would be error to apply those factors, that it didn't express an opinion on the point.
No, that's true. But I think it does direct us to go back and start from square one when we're analyzing the statute and the legislative history, and particularly the legislative declaration.
And can you explain why the declaration is not published with the statute?
I don't know the answer to that. I candidly don't know enough about the legislative process for that.
I'm not sure anybody does. I just wonder if you had any insight as to why. I mean, frequently there are statutes that have the declaration, or at least the statement of legislative intent, published as a part of the statute. It's in the statute, apparently. Whereas here, it's not a part of the statute, and that has come to somewhat disturbs me, that you have to go back to the session laws to find out what an otherwise clear and unambiguous statute means.
Well, and again, the statute is clear and unambiguous in the sense that it confers discretion, but it isn't clear on how the discretion is to be applied, which is what the declaration says. I assume there was some political wrangling or something involved in deciding where to put it. But what we do know is that the legislative declaration was part of the bill, and the bill was voted on by the entire General Assembly. And there are several cases we've cited in our opening brief that say that the legislative declaration is one of the best guides to interpret a statute.
But do you have any cases that say we should consider such a declaration even when the operative statute is not ambiguous?
Well, again, I think the word ambiguous is a little misleading in a case like this. The Carruthers court itself, when it talks about discretion, goes on to say that discretion should be, it's not unbridled discretion. And it cites 8 different cases where it talks about, sure, trial courts have discretion, but there's case law that says you have to narrow that down in light of the...
Well, counsel, I don't think there's a dispute that there's that discretion has to be bridled in some way. But I think that what's interesting about your argument is you're suggesting the statute draws a distinction between how prevailing employers should be treated and prevailing employees. And nothing in the operative language of the statute draws any such distinction. According to that language, they are treated exactly the same. That's where my confusion comes in.
Well, I thought it was interesting that even the Carruthers court didn't go that far, and it said, we're going to reserve a judgment as to how it applies in the case of a prevailing employee. So clearly the Carruthers panel was leaving that door open.
But do you see anything distinguishing between employers and employees in section 8-4-110(1)?
No, I think if you look at the text, you're not going to find anything, but there are inherent...
Well, don't we usually end with the text when it's so clear on that point?
Well, I guess I'm kind of going in circles because it's clear in the sense of conferring discretion as opposed to what it was before when the award was mandatory in favor of the prevailing party. But there are structural differences between an employee and employer. I mean, the employee is always the one bringing the claim. The employee is the one that has the problem of unequal bargaining power. And the entire impetus for the 2007 amendments was that there needed to be greater incentives for employers to pay wages. And that's also set forth in the legislative declaration. So, I don't think it's fair to say we treat differently situated parties the same by applying the discretion in the exact same way or by leaving the door wide open for the trial court to do whatever it wants.
Well, whenever courts are granted discretion, somebody almost automatically comes up with a set of standards or a set of things that you should consider in exercising your discretion. And those have two purposes. One, to have some uniformity in the trial court as to how these matters are decided, and two, to make it more easily reviewable at the appellate level.
Right.
This is the first time I've encountered the legislature using totally different language in a declaration from what is in the statute and ask the courts to construe in accordance with the non-statutory language. Do you know of any other example of that?
Well, I guess I would take issue with your characterization of it being totally different language. I mean, the statute just says may. It's one word. And so it's the legislative declaration is giving courts guidance, just as courts do as case law develops in the discretion area.
But aren't you asking us to interpret may to mean shall? The trial court shall award fees unless special circumstances exist?
Yes. I mean, essentially, we are arguing, based on the Piggy Park, Newman versus Piggy Park case that's expressly cited in the declaration, that yes, there should be a presumption. We start from the point where the employee should get their fees in ordinary circumstances, and then we look for special circumstances that might be...
Mr. Lichtenstein, what, in your view, is the significance of the statement in the Carruthers case that an employee is presumptively entitled to an award of attorney's fees?
Well, I think the Carruthers court was just picking up on the Newman versus Piggy Park case, which is where that concept comes from, as well as the other language in the legislative declaration that says we're going to interpret this as we do the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
So in your view, if an employee is presumptively entitled to an award of attorney's fees, how would that presumption be rebutted by an employer?
Well, again, we have this concept of special circumstances. I don't think this court needs to decide all of those special circumstances. I think the court only needs to decide whether they're present in this case. And there's nothing in the trial court's findings in its order for judgment that suggests any special circumstances. In fact, one of the facts that we can't escape in this case is that because the jury found for the plaintiff on an implied contract theory, we know that they found that the employer should have reasonably expected that Mr. Lester had the reasonable expectation of being paid for his services. So there's nothing special about that. The special circumstances cases involve cases where there's almost no relief granted to a plaintiff. Or maybe the plaintiff himself has acted in, if not in bad faith, in a very circuitous way in pursuing litigation. But I think this is a garden variety wage case.
So, counsel, are you suggesting that if we agree with you that employees are presumptively entitled to their fees if they prevail, that we should simply enter an order awarding fees, or should we remand to the trial court to assess the situation in light of our opinion?
Yes, I think the opinion needs to lay down a rule that says this is how the statute is to be interpreted. You look for the presumption, then you look for something that rebuts the presumption, and that the quality of evidence that's going to rebut it is going to be based on the special circumstances doctrine.
But do you agree we would have to remand to the trial court to conduct that analysis in the first instance?
Yeah.
If we agree with you.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Our alternative theory is that even if the Carruthers factors were properly applied in this case, the trial court also applied some factors that just had no place in any analysis, and they amount to either an abuse of discretion or a use of a legal analysis that's not appropriate. The idea that a nonprofit corporation somehow gets a break because it's devoted to the common good, there's no textual support for that, there's no case support for that. There's case support to the contrary. The idea that because
you're saying shouldn't it be considered in a discretionary call? You're saying the fact that it's a nonprofit shouldn't even be considered by the trial court in making a discretionary call?
I think that gets the courts into the business of making moral judgments about the missions of nonprofits and possibly even profit corporations that may be doing some good out there. There's no authority for that kind of analysis.
Well, rather than say moral, how about policy? It gives the court it's a policy argument or a policy question as to whether nonprofits should or should not receive special attention. And you're saying it's totally improper for the court to consider that.
If it's not improper, it's certainly greatly outweighed by the policy of the Wage Claim Act itself that says that we're going to make sure that employers pay employees promptly and that employees should get paid for what they do.
Well, under an implied contract, wouldn't one be awarded the fair value of the services rather than a contract value?
Yes, that's exactly what happened here. But. Okay. Again, the employer. Well,
I thought he was awarded the $75,000 that he said he was entitled to.
No, he was awarded on the order of $12,000 and another $12,000 roughly in penalties. We don't. Obviously, we're not privy to the jury's analysis.
Well, the $75,000 was an annual salary. So
yeah, he got one paycheck that was based on a $75,000 annual salary. So. I would love to get into the rest of my brief, but frankly, I think I'd rather reserve time for rebuttal.
Actually, can I ask you a quick question? It's a procedural question on the alter ego claims.
Yes.
Did you agree with your opposing counsel and with the court that those would be tried to the court versus tried to the jury? I'm very confused on the procedural history of how that all went down.
You won't see it in the record, but I'm happy to answer that for you.
Well, no, please stick with the record. Does the record tell us why the jury didn't answer the question about whether there was an alter ego?
There was no question submitted to the jury.
But why was that? Because that was a tribal issue initially, wasn't it?
Well,
to the jury?
No. In fact, in our trial brief, and by the way, we were the only ones that demanded a jury trial, but in the trial brief, we said, no, this issue gets tried to the court.
Oh, so in the brief, you stipulated that would be a bench trial issue.
Well, we didn't stipulate. I think
or
the jury
you contended trial, to.
Right.
It. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Richard Luton here on behalf of the Career Building Academy. I agree with my opponent that courts in the exercise of their discretion may not have unbridled discretion, but that's not what the appellee sees here. The court went to great lengths in its order to explain and identify the factors it did consider, and that seems to my client to be the proper use of discretion. In the Carruthers' opinion, which has been talked about quite a bit, they did identify that the Colorado Wage Act language is plain and unambiguous. So even though they went the extra mile in exploring the legislative history, they made it clear that there was no need to. And Similarly, we believe there's no need for this court to go beyond the clear and unambiguous language of the statute.
Mr. Wooten, as I asked Mr. Lichtenstein, the Carruthers opinion said that an employee is presumptively entitled to an award of attorney fees. Do you disagree with that statement in the Carruthers opinion?
I do not disagree with how they got to that, Your Honor. No, in looking at the legislative history, I think that was a fair reading of that history. Where I differ, Your Honor, is that because the statute was plain and unambiguous, there was no need for them to go into that history in this case. But their analysis of the history, I don't take issue with, Your Honor.
Well, then I'm not sure I understand your response. So is your view here that because the statute is unambiguous, that we should not consider whether the plaintiff is presumptively entitled to an award of attorney's fees, or do we nevertheless consider that the plaintiff is presumptively entitled to an award of attorney fees?
I would suggest that under the law of the state, that since it's clear and unambiguous, that you would not consider the legislative history. That only comes into play where there is something unclear or an ambiguity that the court needs to resolve.
So if that's your position, and I can understand that from the Carruthers opinion, does that mean that the legislative declaration would never come into effect or never come into play because the language is unambiguous?
Well, I think when legislatures draft a statute, Your Honor, there's always some concern that at some point what they've drafted, despite their best intentions, may be found to be unclear or ambiguous. And if that had been the case, then yes, it would have been proper to look into that. But since it is not, since the language is clear and unambiguous.
Mr. Wooten,
yes,
sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead and finish your answer if you hadn't finished.
Okay. I was pretty much done.
So a related question, though. The statute, the operative statute, doesn't, even though it gives discretion to a trial court to award fees to a prevailing employee, it doesn't set forth any factors to guide that discretion.
I agree.
So why can't we look to the legislative declaration to ascertain what factors the legislature wanted courts to consider?
I can see that point absolutely, Your Honor. But I think primarily, since the statute was clear and unambiguous, we'd look to subsequent interpretations of it, such as in the Carruthers Court and the Graham Court. Those gave guidance to this trial court as to what to look at. And interestingly, although the court's order never cited to the Graham case, what the court actually did in its analysis in his order seemed to be in lockstep with the factors the Graham court gave to trial courts to consider. And of course, the Graham court was considering a case where an employee had prevailed and was seeking attorney's fees. And of course, those were attorney's fees at the appellate level as opposed to the trial level, but nevertheless, it's a distinction without a difference.
Now, so, Carruthers dealt with an employer's claim.
Carruthers dealt with a case where the employer prevailed.
Prevailed and was seeking fees.
Yes, Your Honor.
Wouldn't a statement in Carruthers that the employee would be presumptively entitled dictum?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it is. In fact, I think all of the Carruthers analysis of the legislative history is in essence dicta, since they'd already decided it was clear and unambiguous. But yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor, absolutely.
Well, on that point, do you think it would be contrary to the plain language of Section 8.4.110 to apply a presumption that prevailing employees are entitled to fees?
No, I don't think it would be contrary.
So we wouldn't be contradicting the plain language of the statute to apply the presumption that the employee asks us to.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree, and I believe the trial court did not just issue its ruling without any identification of what it considered. It was a very careful order and set forth what it considered, including things that Mr. Lichtenstein has said, factors that had no place in this consideration, and I take issue with that. I think the trial judges are charged to consider all relevant factors, and the factors that Mr. Lichtenstein identified as having no place, I believe, are relevant. This is not a garden variety employment case, at least from my perspective, it's not one where an employee is having to go after a large employer to whom payment of legal fees would make no difference. I think the judge carefully considered the fact that this is a small nonprofit that runs on a shoestring. And so he rightfully considered whether the employer in this case could absorb fees, which is one of the factors that I think makes sense based on the case.
When the appellate court set forth factors, have you ever known them to say they're an exhaustive list of the factors?
No, Your Honor.
The trial courts can always consider other things, can they not?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I have that highlighted on my copy right here, that the Carruthers Court said the circumstances typically include the following factors, but certainly would not be limited to them. I think the charge on the trial judges is to consider all relevant factors. And I think that's what the trial court judge did in this case.
Mr. Wooten, do you have any case authority for the notion that a trial court should consider whether the defendant employer is a nonprofit entity versus a for-profit entity?
No, not specifically, Your Honor. I think what the Graham case set forth was just that the party's relative ability to pay and the relative hardship should be considered. And whether a nonprofit status would fit under that umbrella, I'm not sure. But no, Your Honor, I have no case specifically on point for that.
Okay, thank you.
And there was not much discussion of the alter ego theory. However, having not been the attorney at the trial level, I was similarly confused about what went on. But it seemed to me that that the judge was well within his authority to dismiss the alter ego theory based on not presenting it to the jury.
So I have the same question that I have for opposing counsel. So did both parties agree that this was a case issue for the bench to decide?
Your Honor, if that was the case, it wasn't in the record, and I was not able to glean that from my predecessor's file. That's all I can say. I can't say it wasn't, but I can't confirm that it was, Your Honor.
Because I looked at the transcript when the trial court was deciding this issue after the verdicts came out, and it was confusing to me what the trial court said. It seemed to suggest that I, the trial court, didn't give this special interrogatory to the jury because I didn't think the evidence supported it, which is not consistent with treating it as a bench trial issue. So I was very confused by how the parties in the court were treating the issue and whether Rule 41 applies, Rule 50 applies. What do you think?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I was similarly confused, especially during the course of the trial. In ruling on several objections, plaintiff's response to the objection was that this went to the alter ego theory, and that's why they wanted to go to the jury to hear that, have that question answered. But that didn't make sense based on what happened in the end, because the jury didn't get to decide that. So I'm sorry I can't shed more light on that, Your Honor.
Can I ask you about remedy? If we disagree with you and decide the trial court committed some errors with respect to that alter ego theory, what should we do? Should we remand for a jury trial on that question? Should we remand for findings from the trial court? Or what do you think should happen?
Well,
I understand you don't want any of that to happen. First issue, what do you think the remedy should be?
Your Honor, I think justice would be served either way. However, from the sense that I got in reading what is on the record, I would say that it would make more sense to send it back to a jury to decide the alter ego, although I'm sure the court would do a fine job in determining that on its own.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have, Your Honor.
I just wanted to follow up with a question before about the legislative declaration, Mr. Wooten. The legislative declaration in part says that the General Assembly intends courts to interpret the discretionary standard for awards of attorney's fees and costs consistently with the United States Supreme Court's interpretation of attorney fee provisions in the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964. In your view, is that declaration intended to provide guidance to courts in terms of how they exercise their discretion?
Your Honor, I think that was intended to provide guidance should it be needed. But that's...
So I come back to what I was asking you a few minutes ago. If the statute is clear on its face without the legislative declaration, it seems to me that you're saying that courts would never, ever have an occasion to consider the legislative declaration. Is there a situation you can think of where a court might need to look at the legislative declaration?
If their wording of the statute had been ambiguous, Your Honor, yes, absolutely. That's when it's time to dive in. But other than that, no.
But you told us several times now that you don't think the statute is ambiguous.
I don't think it is.
So then it seems like it follows from what you're saying that the legislative declaration would never come into play.
Not for this act, Your Honor.
See, it seems to me your answer to Judge Taubman is contrary to what you told me earlier.
I'm sorry.
The statute, well, maybe I'm wrong if I just misunderstood you, but I thought you said that the statute doesn't address what factors a trial court should consider in whether to award fees. So therefore, it would be consistent with that statute to consider the presumption that's discussed in the legislative declaration.
I agree, Your Honor, that it does not provide factors to be considered, but many statutes do not. And those are oftentimes provided for us by learned members of this bench as things go forward. But in the absence of factors, but with a clear statute, I think the trial court does not need to dive into the legislative history.
But the trial court needs to have some basis for its decision-making, and why can't it look to the legislative declaration as a starting point?
I don't know that they cannot, Your Honor. I guess it goes back to the basic argument that if the statute is clear and unambiguous, then they don't need the legislative guidance. Now, of course, in this case, this trial court had guidance from both Carruthers and Graham, and I think this judge adequately and properly applied those factors in reaching his decision.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel brought up the Graham case, and I guess I'm going to have to address it. One of the factors that he relies on is that the trial court referenced the fact that TCBA is a small nonprofit operating on a shoestring, but the trial court failed to consider that even in Carruthers, the factor that should be taken into account is the relative hardship of both parties. No consideration at all was given to Mr. Lester's ability to absorb his fees. And in fact, it should be apparent that in a case with a judgment this size, after a three-day trial and a bunch of discovery, it's going to eat up a great deal of his recovery. But Graham, in any event, I think I've covered this quite a bit in my brief, but interestingly, the briefs filed in that case make virtually no argument about the applicability of 84110 to a prevailing plaintiff. There was nothing in the opening brief. The appellant was the employer. The employee's brief simply said, because we won a trial, we should get fees on appeal if we win, and there was no response to that. So there was nothing before the court to review, and I would submit that even Graham is dicta in light of that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.